I guess so. So indeed, what I'd like to talk about today is some work on singularity resolution within the context of the gravity gauge correspondences. And the main part of what I'll talk about is contained in this paper here with Joe Polchinski and Alex Buchel, who's a postdoc at ITP. And I'll also make some brief remarks about some works in progress with Johnson, Myers, Ross, and also Meroff. So let me begin just with an outline. I'll first begin just with an introduction, which is basically a very quick review of the story about the enhanceon, which arises in a realization of the N equals 2 supersymmetric gauge theory systems with brains. And I'll talk about the central role of a brain probe of this geometry as giving rise to understanding how the singularity that appears in the classical space-time is resolved. And there is a locus that we call the enhanceon, a place where there's enhanced gauge symmetry. And the way we see this is looking for where the tension of this probe brain goes to zero, and by finding out that the probe brain can't go inside this locus, we find out that the singularity is resolved. I'll make a few comments about the finite temperature supergravity story for the realization where you wrap some D-brains on K3 to try to make the N equals 2 gauge theory. The paper that I'll be highlighting is one in which we did a brain probe analysis of the N equals 2 star flow geometry of Pilk and Warner. Again, the probe brain played a central role in understanding the physics that's going on here. We found out that the source brains in this geometry were just D3 brains in a admittedly rather complicated configuration. And in the coordinates where the N equals 2 structure in the moduli space of this brain probe was manifest, we found out that this time the enhanceon, instead of being a ring, effectively was a line segment. And we managed to find the brain distribution by comparing to gauge theory. I'll also mention a little bit about making this whole story non-commutative, and end, if I've got time, with a brief remark about a non-commutative version of something I reported on at Strings 99. So my motivation in studying this was basically the story of what to do with classical space-time singularities in string or M theory. And as pointed out a few years ago by Horowitz and Myers, there are two ways in which classical singularities might be resolved. One of them is that they actually are resolved by quantum effects, but there's a second possibility, and that is that the geometries are just completely disallowed. They're just bogus, and the reason for that is that if they were resolved, there would be a contradiction in the form of vacuum instability. And of course, the canonical example of this is the negative Mach-Schwarzschild geometry. So in looking in classical solutions in classical string or M theory, we come across all sorts of singularities, clothed and naked, null, time-like, and space-like, all the kinds of varieties. But my basic view on this is that if you make a geometry, a classical geometry, that's really just built out of fundamental objects like D-brains and strings, then it should somehow have a resolution, because string theory is really supposed to know what to do when cycles on which brains are wrapped become small. So there are resolution mechanisms known for specific systems. One of the things that we know by studying just even the BPS DP brains that are not the three-brain geometries in 10 dimensions is that they have null singularities. I'll just point out here that the six-brain geometry is not commonly known, really is a naked singularity in that it takes a photon of finite affine time to get from the singularity to you. That's not the case for any of the smaller brains. But in any case, if you take these P-brain geometries in the decoupling limit, as studied by Itzaki and Maldesen and Sonnenschein and Yankelevitz, you find that, in a sense, these singularities are really resolved by some other theory taking over in the region where the supergravity geometry goes bad. And then there is the N equals 2 story that we found in the enhanceon story, where time-like naked singularities are resolved by the brain expansion mechanism that I'll just briefly review. Interestingly enough, there hasn't really been very much said about space-like singularities yet, and I would like to be able to say something about that, but not today. There are also many related works, and one of them is the N equals 1 star dielectric brain expansion story of Polchinski-Strassler. There have been many, many other people who've done important things since then. I haven't got time to go mention them individually, and I also apologize to people who I didn't manage to put on this list. But for the remainder of my talk, I'll be concentrating on the N equals 2 and N equals 2 star systems, because that's what I know the most about. So just a very quick reminder, what is this enhanceon story? How did it arise? And why do we care? One of the realizations of doing P plus one-dimensional gauge theory with N equals two supersymmetry is to take just a bunch of P brains that are got four more dimensions and wrap them on a K3. This wrappage of the K3 on the K3 induces a minus N units of the lower brain charge, DP brain. Now, I'll just pick a particular P, which is P equal 2, simply for convenience. It's not really crucial to what I have to say. For the P greater than 3 system, because, for example, you'd have to use 7 brains the to get the 3 plus 1 system, the geometry is not asymptotically flat, and that makes things rather more complicated. If you look at P less than or equal to 1, the gauge theories have wild infrared fluctuations, so the easiest thing to study is just the P equals 2 case. So how do we get the classical geometry? Well, your first guess when you try and sit down and build it is just simply that you would take some harmonic functions that correspond to having the big brain charge. In this case, that's 6 brains. And then also because of this induced DP brain charge. It's not really DP brain charge in that there aren't any real DP brains there, but effectively in the supergravity geometry, it just looks like you have a bunch of D2 brains which are smeared over the K3, and then you simply use the harmonic function rule to write down the metric. And in the decoupling limit, which we take, the 6 brain function is just as you might expect. It goes like 1 over R. U is just the usual radius measured in energy units. But the harmonic function of the 2 brain, the effective 2 brains, the bogus ones, has this funny minus sign in it. Now, just point out that all these constants here, except for the U dependence, are actually just the Atoft coupling up to a factor of 2. And then you can just look at this geometry and see that the supergravity solution is singular when this harmonic function goes to 0. You can calculate the curvatures, and unfortunately, there's a nasty singularity. So that happens at the Atoft coupling divided by 2, and so in the large Atoft coupling limit, it is a very macroscopically large radius that you think you see. This was dubbed the repulsion in a related context by Kalosh and Linde because it repelled massive particles that were following geodesics in the background. So, in fact, the place where you think the horizon is, if you just look at this geometry up here, is at U equals 0, so the singularity is naked. But it's not really a finite radius singularity because the transverse metric here, the things that measure the sizes of the little transverse spheres, actually goes to 0 at that point, so it really is a point singularity and you can't go inside it. So how do you see that it's resolved? You use another 6 brain wrapped on the K3 as a probe. Remembering the fact that K3 is curved, you derive an action. And the only point about this effectively is that there's a velocity squared term, and there's a piece in it that you can think of as the sort of effective tension, which is a function of the radius here. And the moduli space metric goes to 0 at a radius which we dub the enhanced-on radius, because when the effective size of the K3 around which the probe is wrapping goes to the self-dual volume, there's an enhanced SU2, and that occurs at twice the radius that you would have had for the repulsion singularity. And we argued in the paper with Petrinsky and Johnson that this meant that effectively the probe couldn't move inside the enhanced-on locus. It sort of came up against a brick wall. And then if you tried to build this configuration by taking one and then adding another one and adding another one and so forth, you wouldn't actually get a singular geometry. You would instead get a Dyson sphere of brains. In the case of what's relevant to 3 plus 1 physics, you would get a ring. And because the naked singularity would have been inside, the singularity is resolved. So this is the brain expansion enhanced-on phenomenon. And on the gauge theory side, you could see this brain expansion non-perturbatively looking at the Seiberg-Witten curve. You can look for the places where there's enhanced gauge symmetries and so forth. And this is plotted in the plane for the probe. And I'll just mention that although these brains look like they're a finite distance apart from one another, in the supergravity approximation, they become densely right next to each other. So I'll just make a couple of comments about the finite temperature version of this whole story, partly because there was a typo, a sign error in the original paper, and I just wanted to mention how that changes some of the physics that we talked about. Generally, if you have a harmonic function for a DP brain, and you want to ask how do things change when you introduce non-extremality, then one of the ways of parametrizing it is just to say that if this was the function for the BPS brain, you just multiply by an additional factor that depends on how much non-extremality you add. And you also have to, of course, add the non-extremality function telling you about the horizons in the time and radial pieces of the metric. And you also have to divide the Ramon-Ramon form by this same little factor here. And you can parametrize it just in terms of the horizon radius of the non-extremal geometry and a thing that used to be in the BPS harmonic function. And I'll just point out here that if R naught goes to zero. In other words, you take the BPS limit, this alpha thing goes to one, and you get back the BPS geometry that you had before. While if you send the non-extremality parameter to be really big, then alpha becomes very small. I'll just point out that although you're dividing the Ramond form by a small number here, other things happen such that you don't get a contradiction of Ramond forms blowing up. Okay, so one of the things that I mentioned on the previous page is that the effective two-brain harmonic function in that supergravity geometry at a funny minus sign, the fact that when you add non-extremality to this whole story, the mass is still positive, the change in the mass is positive, means that the six-brain non-extremality parameter behaves as you would expect, but in fact, the two-brain non-extremality parameter gets a peculiar plus sign, which means in this case that the parameter telling us about the non-extremality effect on the harmonic function and so forth runs between 1 and infinity, not between 1 and 0. So this means, in fact, that the locus where the kinetic energy of a probe of the system goes to 0 is actually bigger than in the BPS case, not smaller. You also find that the repulsion radius in this geometry, which has changed when you go to the non-extremal situation, is always outside the horizon. Okay, so just a couple of very brief remarks about this. In the decoupling limit, the change in the six-brain harmonic function is unity. This is just a statement of the rule that we tell ourselves that in the decoupling limit, all we have to worry about is those horizon functions k in front of the time and the radial components of the metric. It's non-BPS, and of course, there's going to be a potential energy. The probe is going to get attracted into the center of the space-time. And this piece here comes effectively from the six-brain part. It's negative, as you'd expect. There's an attraction. And because this alpha 2 parameter, this thing that parameterizes the non-extremality, has this peculiar sign in it, that part is also negative. And you can compute the kinetic energy, and you find that the enhancer is always outside where you thought the horizon would be. And this is just an indication that the field theory to which this is dual, the correct dual for this is probably not the supergravity, at least not involving a black hole type story. And some of the stuff in progress is to do with the precise configuration of brains that's really sitting there at the center of the non-extremal version of this space-time. So that was just, I want to make a brief remark. What I want to get onto now is the what I want to highlight, which is sorting out via the brain probe story an understanding of the N equals 2 star geometry that Pilk and Warner found. We thought it looked rather complicated to start with, but once we did the probe analysis, it seemed to become much nicer, so I just wanted to tell you about that. So what they did is say, suppose we turn on these combinations of operators in the gauge theory, in the conformal field theory, we break the symmetry to N equals 2 by turning on masses for these fermions, then what happens in the dual space-time? And they use the consistent truncation ansatz to construct the supergravity solution. It involves tour de force calculations. One of the things that I just want to point out is that in this consistent truncation ansatz, there's a finite number of integration constants. And if you compare that to the gauge theory moduli space, you'd expect to have a really large number of parameters. So this Pilk-Warner geometry is going to be actually a one-parameter subspace of all of the possible gauge theory configurations. And so we want to find out which one. I also mentioned that if you want to understand the singularity structure for a supergravity geometry, you really should do it in 10 dimensions because that's where things are most manifest and easiest to understand. So the new features of this geometry versus other ones before is that the 10-dimensional dilaton, which is the thing that controls effectively that coupling function, varies with the radius, and it depends on some angles. The 5-square is squashed. There are some complicated Ramond and Niver-Schwartz forms turned on. And for the purposes of some formulas later on, I'll just point out that in the solution, there are two parameters. One of them is gamma. This is the thing that's going to parameterize how much the n equals 4 is broken to n equals 2. And there's also a dimensionless parameter k, which is related to the mass of these fermions up here in units of the ADS radius L, but we'll show how to fix that by talking about the physics of the probe. So one of the things I might do is just put up a short summary of some of the supergravity fields that appear. It's rather more complicated than N equals 2 geometry, of course. But just talk about some symmetries. The N equals 2 star theory has an SU2 cross U1R symmetry. You can see this just by looking at the fermions, of which there are four Weyl fermions. The numbers 3 and 4, when we turned on that perturbation that I wrote on the previous transparency, they get a mass, and there's a U1 that mixes them. And the other two remain massless, and so they have an SU2, and that's where they come from. The six scalars, if you looked at them as an SO6 representation, transform like this. But two of them turn out to be invariant under this R symmetry for the N equals 2. And so what we're going to find, if we look at the moduli space for the probe, if there's going to be a fixed plane where the radius of some transverse squashed spheres go to zero. And so what we're going to find is that the probe moduli space is actually just two-dimensional. I'll just mention also that the R symmetry doesn't act on the azimuthal angle that appears in the space-time metric here. And the fields actually depend on it in a complicated fashion. Lastly, the Pope-Warner solution actually has an accidental symmetry, which is only manifest in the supergravity approximation to the physics, because it is actually a combination of the original SO6, or some subgroup of that original thing, and the SL2R symmetry that's a symmetry of supergravity. This thing leaves the mass perturbation invariant. So how might we go about understanding this N equals 2 star geometry? So on the face of it, it looks kind of complicated. I mean, the Einstein metric has a whole bunch of stuff in it. One of the things that I'd mention is that we've written the radial coordinate in their conventions, which is a coordinate C. It's related to one that you might be more familiar with by this cosh down here. One of the things that you can see is that if R goes to infinity, in other words, you go out to the faraway region, effectively the boundary in the old ADS story, then this C thing goes to 1. And in fact, many of these other complicated functions like rho and the x thingies, they all go to 1 as well. And so the geometry is, in fact, asymptotically ADS5 times S5. It's just not terribly easy to see in these coordinates. So there's a whole load of objects turned on, Ramond-Ramond forms. There is the 10-dimensional dilaton, which does run. So there is, in principle, also an axion turned on in this geometry. So what we've got to do in order to analyze the physics of the probe is just to take this whole mess for the probe action involving all these pieces, pull back the appropriate supergravity things to the probe, and then ask what's going on. Also, I'll just point out again, it's much easier to understand the physics that's going on if you do the analysis using the 10-dimensional geometry, not the 5-dimensional geometry. But the analysis isn't actually as awful as it looks, because various of the components that appear in this action actually go away and don't bother you. For example, the components of the B fields vanish and there is no field strength on the brain, and cross terms that appear in the definition for the five-form field strength don't actually appear in this equation. So with a bit of work, you just find the zeros of the potential energy, the place where it doesn't cost you to move around, and you find that in terms of the coordinates that you see here, there's the equator of the five sphere. And also, there's a special radius. And exactly where this happens in terms of the parameter R, or C, is dictated by this parameter gamma, this thing that's going to tell us about how close we are to N equals 2 as compared to N equals 4. One of the small technical details we found is that we needed two coordinate patches in order to uncover this fixed plane that we saw was required by the R symmetry analysis. One of them was the rho phi plane. And there was also a piece involving theta and phi. OK, so we have this moduli space, which is two-dimensional, big deal. We'd like to just see what the metric is. And from that, what we're going to do is try to uncover the structure of the distribution of brains. And the way we're going to do that is, first of all, to change to some coordinates. We're not going to use these coordinates here, but we're going to use some coordinates which are natural in terms of the N equals 2 structure. What we'd like to write is that the kinetic energy function for some complex coordinate y that parameterizes the two-dimensional moduli space is just the velocity, and then we're going to have the imaginary part of the supergravity coupling function as the coefficient. This would be a thing that really makes the N equals 2 supersymmetry structure quite manifest. And it's going to allow us to compare to a calculation we can do in the gauge theory and find out what the distribution of brains looks like. So once you find this coordinate transformation that takes you from C's to Y's, and Y, by the way, the angular part is just the phi coordinate that I mentioned that things depend on non-trivially here, And you find that the coupling function, this thing which is a combination of the dilaton and the axion, looks like this. There's a square root stuff in here, but it is, as expected, a holomorphic function of the coordinate. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, I've only been speaking for 18 minutes. I know, but I can count. We look at different regions of this parameter space parameterized by gamma. It turns out that in the Polk-Warner solution, the gamma equals zero is the thing that tells us that we're as far as we can get with their solution towards the n equals two. And Polk and Warner said in their paper that they thought they saw a ring which corresponded to our enhanceon. But in fact, once you do this coordinate transformation, you find that what you thought was a circle of source brains, of D3 brains, actually turns into a line segment of brains in these natural n equals 2 coordinates. So you can imagine that the brains that are giving rise to this geometry are just sitting on this little line segment. And so in this case, we have a linear enhanceon. We can actually check that it is an enhanceon by checking that the kinetic energy does go to zero on the cut. I'll just mention for those of you who know the Polchinski-Strassler story that this is not just the n equals 2 limit of their ellipsoid that they get collapsing down to a line segment, because the perturbation that we're looking at is quite different here. Anyway, as you decrease gamma, the line segment here unsquashes and it becomes an ellipse, and then eventually as you let gamma go to minus infinity in this geometry, you find that you get back just the n equals 4 Coulomb branch problem, the fact that you end up with just a shell of D3 brains. So what we've seen from the point of view of the supergravity is that this enhance on brain expansion thing tends to make the distribution of brains big enough to resolve the singularity structure. And in this case, we find that, in fact, the supergravity is non-singular if you measure it in the string frame. But that they don't just expand enormously. They keep as compact as they possibly could. But what we'd like to do now is to take the gauge theory side of the story and unpack the distribution of brains. So we just demand that the coupling function in supergravity is the same as it is in the Yang-Mills theory. We're just relying on the BPS property here. You can, starting from the Seiberg-Witten story, break the gauge symmetry, which is always broken quantum mechanically, by turning on some eigenvalues. You can compute the classical, the perturbative, and sometimes you can even do something with the non-perturbative pieces and the prepotential. The perturbative piece is one loop exact, and you get it by just integrating out charged W's and pieces and hypermultiplets. The non-perturbative piece is actually hard to find for a large rank of the gauge group, at least we thought it was. Perhaps the speaker who's coming next will have some nice things to say about that. But it's only important, this piece, when you have got really very light BPS states, and that involves the eigenvalue spacings, these things A being order 1 over n or less. And it turns out that we won't need to worry about them in the supergravity regime that we're concerned about. So if you have the brains at positions AI, then you can compute the perturbative contributions to this coupling function tau as a function of u, the position of the probe. This is the thing that's going to be dual to our little y coordinate, which was the coordinate on the supergravity moduli space that made everything manifest in terms of n equals 2 supersymmetry. And I'll just rush a little bit because I'm running low on time, that if you match to the supergravity coupling function we had, you can unpack what the distribution of brains is on that linear enhanceon, and it's a semicircle distribution. Also just mention that the non-perturbative corrections that we were talking about, because they're pretty well suppressed, we don't see them much. But if you get right onto the enhanceon, then you would have to worry about these light BPS states, and the non-perturbative corrections would turn on. So I guess the story that we're trying to draw from this is just that by using the physics of the probe, probing the supergravity geometry and comparing to expectations in the gauge theory, you can learn a lot about what the geometry is made of and so forth. And it might be that by studying the gauge theory closer, we can get some clues about how to extend the solution, which is just one parameter subspace of the whole possible moduli space of solutions, might be able to construct a more general solution. So I'll just say a couple more things. Be very quick. We decided that we would try to make this whole story non-commutative, and just by using a bunch of TNS dualities, it's actually pretty straightforward, if very messy, to do the supergravity computation. And what we wanted to check was whether the supergravity Metricon moduli space was changed, and whether this jived with our expectations from gauge theory, and the answer is that it was unaffected. And you can argue also that that's something that you expect from the non-commutative story. So I'll just end by advertising something that's a bit in progress. A little while ago, I talked about the story of taking a little brain, which is in static equilibrium with a bigger one at finite separation, and asking what happens as the separation goes to zero. We found that there was a baldness situation if you had little brains and hair if you had big ones. It just seemed like an obvious thing to do to make this to find a non-commutative version of this. You do still expect, because the dimensionalities of the field theory was the thing that really drove this physics to get about the same results, but what we can do now is to use this recent construction that Manuela mentioned of Ferrucci, which is the gauge theory configuration relevant to having P plus 4 brains and P brains with a separation parameter, which is what we really wanted, and a preliminary investigation has actually yielded the same results as before. So that's it.
Thank you. Questions?
When you take the supersymmetry breaking parameter away, the gamma to minus infinity, I think was your notation. If my memory serves, you should carry over to a Coulomb branch state, which is a uniform disk, not a shell. Is that in agreement with what you found? I'm referring, it's the one of the solutions that Krauss-Larsen and Trivedi found.
Right.
The uniform disk.
Yeah, we didn't actually do the computation of the distribution of brains to find out whether it was a disk or a ring in that case. But in the case where you do send the parameter gamma to minus infinity, you don't expect to see a ring because the kinetic energy doesn't go to zero as you approach this locus. So it's not an enhance-on that's occurring when you take gamma goes to minus infinity. So I would expect that, as you say, you would expect to get a disk distribution rather than a ring.
Thanks.
Could you explain again, in the finite temperature case, how you interpret the enhancement always being outside the horizon? It seems surprising from the gauge theory point of view.
How would I interpret the fact that the enhancement is outside the horizon? Well, I think one thing that's sort of easier to interpret from my point of view is that the repulsion radius is always outside the horizon. So in some sense, you know, what you have in the BPS case is a naked singularity. You thought you had a horizon, but actually you don't. And somehow, even when you turn on finite temperature, this nasty supergravity solution knows that it's not supposed to have a true horizon. So what we would be investigating is to find out how the brains arrange themselves to have some sort of resolution of the singularity, as in the BPS case. But that's still in progress. Does that answer the question?
More or less.
Any other question? Okay, if there are no more questions, let us thank Professor Amandapet again.